In the coming week, the Democratic nominating race for U.S. president ramps up after a flawed Iowa vote. The African Union holds a summit in Addis Ababa, and international films feature prominently at the 92nd Academy Awards. It's February 6, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, it's safe to say the political temperature has risen in the United States. We had a vote this past Monday in Iowa that is still being tabulated, it seems like, although almost finished now. But it's cast a dark light on the democratic process at a time when there's already a lot of controversy in the country. So can you walk us through what's happening in the upcoming vote in New Hampshire, as well as what to make of Iowa?
Happy to do so, Bob. And let me preface it by saying that I'm about to be critical of the voting process in Iowa. But having lived in the great state of Iowa for a dozen years, all four of my children were born in Iowa City, Iowa. I love the state very much, but Iowa has egg all over its face after Monday night's debacle. It's the only way it can be described. I should point out it was a debacle for the Democrats, not for the Republicans. It also held their caucuses. President Trump won that, unsurprisingly, with 97% of the vote. But on the Democratic side, we're now 72 hours after the caucuses ended, and we're still not sure who won. It looks to be a neck-to-neck race between Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Mayor Pete Buttigieg, former mayor of South Bend, Indiana. And I should note that when he was a younger man, Mayor Pete won a essay contest by writing about how Bernie Sanders was his political hero. So there's that thing to it. It's not clear how the results of Iowa are going to play into the next big event, New Hampshire, which is on Tuesday night. Now, New Hampshire is a primary. We should get clearer results more rapidly from that, and you won't have the complexities you have in the Iowa caucus system. But before we get to Tuesday night and the results from New Hampshire, we're going to have a debate. It's going to happen tomorrow night, Friday night, in Manchester, New Hampshire, on the campus of St. Anselm College. And we're going to get seven leading Democratic candidates on the same debate stage. We're going to see what they talk about. Obviously, the results in Iowa are going to be a big topic, but also the other big news of the week, obviously, President Trump's acquittal in his impeachment trial.
Yeah, and you know, we try to pay attention, obviously, to foreign policy issues here at the council and as they relate to the campaign, and they have not been dominant themes, but foreign policy has mattered and is playing out in the course of this campaign. So one could imagine any number of topics they could point to, including the ever hot button issue of immigration.
Certainly we can talk about immigration, but I would also add Afghanistan, the Middle East, President Trump's proposed peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. We have North Korea. We still have the issue of Ukraine and Russia, climate change, lots of issues that could be talked about. It's not at all clear to what extent the debate is actually going to address foreign policy issues, given everything else that is happening in the news.
And we don't know in Iowa whether or not there were any major issues resonating. Obviously, Iowa being a big farm state, there was blowback from the U.S.-China tariff war and so forth. But we're not sure whether trade is going to be, you know, front and center.
Trade hasn't been a big issue. It certainly wasn't a big issue in Iowa. It didn't come up a lot on the campaign trail. Elections matter a lot for U.S. foreign policy. But the reverse isn't true. Foreign policy seldom matters a lot for elections. People vote on lots of other issues or ideas or motives than what's happening out there in the world. Now, note the Elizabeth Warren campaign for a while was tracking what kinds of questions they were getting from constituents, getting from voters when they were holding all these campaign town halls and the like. And they had collected over 600 questions. I think only about 5% of them had anything really to do with foreign policy. So foreign policy tends not to be the issue driving elections. But I do think it's important to sort of keep an understanding of the campaign, because obviously who becomes president matters a lot for the way U.S. foreign policy goes. I think an Al Gore presidency would have looked very different from a George W. Bush presidency. And I think safe to say a secretary or president Hillary Clinton administration would have looked different from the current Donald Trump administration.
And I'll take this moment to shamelessly tout our election materials on the website. We've ramped it up this particular cycle. Jim, you on our sister podcast, the President Inbox, are doing a series of interviews with experts who don't always agree on the major issues facing the next administration. We've got a special video explainer series with our colleague Shannon O'Neill, walking people through issues like, you know, who pays for tariffs, for example. And then we have a whole set of trackers of the main candidates and what their positions are on a whole host of foreign policy issues. So we are trying to map out what is facing the next administration. And as you say, Jim, even if it's not echoing through the chambers of Iowa caucus halls or New Hampshire debate arenas, it does matter.
Oh, it's certainly does. does. And I just would add one more thing to that list of offerings at CFR's Election 2020 site, and that is the survey questions that we did with many of the presidential challengers, Democratic and Republican, asking their views on foreign policy issues. So that's sort of in one place where you can get a real sense of what candidates think about issues like how do you handle or balance U.S. interests in China with Chinese activity against the Uyghurs in Xinjiang or the democracy protests in Hong Kong. What do the candidates say about Afghanistan and a variety of other issues? So I recommend that to people. But Bob, let's go around the world and we'll go to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. That's where the 33rd ordinary session of the Assembly of the African Union will take place this week. Members of the African Union will convene for the meeting as part of the annual African Union Summit. The theme for the summit is Silencing the Guns, Creating Conductive Conditions for Africa's Development. Tell us more, Bob.
Well, the issue is about Africa trying to, as ever, at least recently, make development and economic issues the prominent issues and make them less about some of the disasters they've had to deal with, whether it's conflict-driven, climate-driven, or what have you. The United Nations is playing a big role in trying to convene this. The Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, will be at the summit. And they are trying to get Africa on a sounder footing, and they're seeing the AU as a potential vehicle, you know, slowly moving into shape to help in areas like governance. And I think you're going to hear a lot about in this summit, Jim, is countries continuing to stress the importance of proper governance, transparency, as the building blocks for countries avoiding conflict. The UN has noted about backsliding in violence on the continent. Between 2005 and 2018, from 7 to 21 conflicts have now risen there. And, you know, whether it's the high-profile ones that Americans tend to know about versus, you know, against al-Shabaab, for example, in Somalia, or in the west of Africa, where there's also jihadi groups active, or Boko Haram in Nigeria, there's a whole list of other conflicts as well. AU has played some role, and there is some guarded hope that it could play a bigger role. It helped broker what it so far held as a transitional peace process in Sudan, where the former dictator was ousted and led away in handcuffs. And there is move toward what many hope will be a transition to civilian government there. We'll see if that plays out. Sudan and its neighbor South Sudan have had a lot of difficult history recently, but the AU has shown it wants to get involved in these. We should note that the AU has a rotating leadership. This year it goes to South Africa, which could be very fortuitous for this focus on, you know, getting back to governance and economic matters. South Africa, while it has its set of challenges, certainly is seen as in the forefront of countries that abide by the rule of law. It's going to be interesting, for example, to watch how South Africa deals with its former leader, Jacob Zuma, who's facing corruption charges and is currently believed to be in Cuba, actually. And there could be a case against him brewing where the existing government under Cyril Ramaphosa may have to move forward with pursuing a case against him. That would be big.
Do we have any sense, Bob, that South Africa is going to make it a priority to actually act on the rhetorical goals of the summit? Because for South Africa, that would require it to make some potentially unpleasant choices about putting pressure on countries. And South Africans have traditionally had a sort of a stronger view of sovereignty and not intervening in other countries. And I'm not even really clear whether the South Africans, even if they wanted to, could mobilize other capitals in Africa to act on these issues.
It's a really good point, Jim. You have seen some other countries try to exhibit leadership, countries that have faced their own problems and have been accused of problems in the past, let's say Rwanda in recent history. And that's why I say it's in sort of this gradual but seemingly steady move toward trying to promote and enforce a sense of transparency and rule of law. The first major statement I've seen from President Ramaphosa has been about using the African summit to promote equality, economic equality for women, so making gender equality a big issue. And maybe through that sort of approach, Africa using its diplomatic weight, its weight in other chambers to promote women's equality, maybe a more subtle way of trying to enhance the role of women throughout the continent. And there has been a pronounced effort to try to get women more involved in peacekeeping, but also in leadership in countries, with the hope that there will be fewer conflicts flaring up as you have more of a women's representation involved on the continent. This is something that's been a theme of the UN, especially for the last 20 years. There was a famous, I think it's 20 years since the UN Security Council passed a famous resolution about the role of women in peace and security. So back to your original question, Jim, I think it would be striking to see South Africa sort of overtly use its pressure to try to push countries in a direction of governance. say there was a country involved in an election that was sketchy and it wanted to either nudge away the previous leadership or push for a revote, that would be a big change. Africa still seems to be afflicted with the leadership for life syndrome, the presidents for life. But there have been some signs that it's trying to move the ball forward.
Okay, I want to change gears, Bob, and move to what I think is your favorite segment every year on The World Next Week, and that's when we talk about the Oscars. We are going to have Sunday night, I think it's a 92nd meeting of the Academy Awards, and a lot of films on the docket, and we like to talk about the best international feature films. In that case, there are 6 nominations total, and from what I can gather from the chit-chat on Twitter and elsewhere, that the leader among the nominated films is Parasite. It was directed by the South Korean director Bong Joon-ho. He has been praised for the film's genre-bending approach. I haven't seen the movie, but I'm told it combines suspense and humor and horror. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about who's competing for the award.
I would be happy to, Jim. As you note, it is one of the high points of my World Next Week calendar to tee up the Academy Awards. And partly it is because in the time we've been doing this podcast even, you've seen more and more of an international role, whether it's in the regular categories that we're seeing an international cast of characters and directors and so forth. But increasingly with the globalization of film and culture like everything else, Americans are sort of getting different perspectives through these films that they're seeing and documentaries. Extraordinary number of documentaries this year in particular that have foreign themes, Jim. But let me go through the main categories first. And I think you're right to mention the movie Parasite is generating a lot of buzz, even some dark horse buzz, as the best picture, period. It's nominated for best picture as well as best of the international feature films. I think Roma was another recent film that was in both of those categories and one international film. But Parasite from director Bong Joon-ho, first time a South Korean film has been nominated in the best picture category. I did see it recently. I didn't know what to make of the description of comedy and horror, and it is certainly both. It is quite a ride. It was one of those movies that you're thinking about for days afterwards and trying to sort out a few things in your head and everything else. But suffice to say, it's at the very least, you could say it's a movie about class divisions, class struggle, human nature, and something that anybody from any country can kind of connect with, I think.
Is it in Korean?
It is in Korean. There's some English interspersed, and it's English plays a slight role in the movie because there is a family, sort of down-at-the-heels family, that gets a chance to start making some money off of a well-to-do family. And one way is through tutoring one of the teenage daughter of the rich family in English. And so you see some English enter in and little sprinkles of English here and there. But the rest of it is subtitle. It's a subtitle experience. But mobile phones feature prominently in it. There is a great deal of humor at the beginning of it, and which is why when it starts to turn really dark, it gets a little bit traumatic. But I can see why it's nominated. I'm not sure if it's going to have the staying power to win Best Picture overall, but probably a favorite in the Best
Who's
International.
Who's your call for Best Picture overall?
I guess I'm leaning towards 1917, this look at World War One. I don't know if you saw that yourself or it's on your list.
I think the only movie I have seen that has been nominated for an Academy Award was Little Women, which I enjoyed very much.
I saw that as well. And on the international note, it's interesting to note that the 4 American girls depicted in the movie were all played by non-American actresses.
Yes, I noticed that when I read a review after seeing the movie.
But let me run through the nominees for Best International Feature Film, Jim. So in addition to Parasite, South Korea's entry, there is Corpus Christi from Poland. The theme is a...
So it's not about a city in Texas.
It is not about a city in Texas, but about an imposter, somebody who impersonates a Catholic priest and a whole sort of context for that. Another movie that's getting a lot of buzz is called Honeyland from North Macedonia, the new country of North Macedonia.
I didn't even know North Macedonia had a film industry.
It has a film industry, and there has been a great deal of positive buzz about, pardon the pun, about this movie, which is set among beekeepers in rural North Macedonia. It involves a clash between sort of traditional industry and migrant workers and so forth. There's a lot of interesting themes teasing out in a movie that's seen as, at the end of the day, a very environmentally themed movie. There is a new take or modern take on Les Miserables from a French movie of the same name. Then there is a movie from Spain called Pain and Glory, which is a very personal piece from the famed director Pedro Almodovar. And that also is getting some buzz that it might be a candidate for Best International Feature as well. I should mention the documentaries include one produced by Michelle and Barack Obama, American Factory. This is about a Chinese glass factory that opens up in Ohio and some of the clashes that ensue over the running of this factory. There's lots of themes that are resonating today in this movie. So we will see the Obamas, I would assume, at the Academy Awards ceremony, Jim. 2 movies related to Syria, one called The Cave, another called Forsama. The Cave is actually a Syrian-Danish film. There's a movie also generating a bit of buzz in Brazil, the Brazilian movie The Edge of Democracy, sort of charting the rise towards the Bolsonaro government and how it got there and how divisions in that country led to the current political situation there. Honeyland is also nominated as a documentary feature. So there's a twofer for that film, too, from North Macedonia. And then there's documentaries in the short subject category also include a South Korean movie, a movie from Afghanistan called Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone, a movie from Sweden called Life Overtakes Me. So it is a it's going to be a ceremony, Jim, with lots of international flavor.
Okay, so I have to ask you, Bob, how do people see these movies? I don't go to many movie theaters. I don't walk by many of them. But when I do, they tend to be showing Hollywood blockbusters or there's some sort of retro theater bringing back old classics. Where does one find these foreign language films?
The documentaries increasingly are available through streaming. I know that because in the last couple of years, there were some that caught our attention, our household, and we went
to— Can you
we
define the, for me as being an old man what streaming is?
Well, so if you have a Netflix account—
Okay, get that. Netflix,
and Netflix is,
Prime,
is in many is increasingly producing its own movies, and so it's kind of weighing the cinematic release with the home streaming release, both of which have, obviously have their merits. We saw the movie Parasite, actually, on Netflix.
Oh, you can see it on Netflix?
Yeah.
Oh, so, well, that's good. I didn't know that.
So I think streaming is obviously the new thing, so that's something you should look for. You have certain larger cities, New York.
Yeah, I assume if you're in New York, you can see a lot
of
these
still
things.
Have the art house effect. And I was up there several weeks ago, and people were chatting about all the movies they'd seen, and I was getting jealous because so many good movies are you know, on the big screen. You know, so I think there's no substitute for that, even in the age of streaming. However, home screens are getting bigger and bigger, and they're making streaming easier and easier. So that's the way I think you're going to see sort of a stampede towards streaming after these awards come out, and the people want to sort of see what they're hearing about. The Academy Award ceremonies, as people may note, typically show little snippets and features of all the nominees before you get to the awarding. So there's a little bit of a teaser there.
Well, obviously, that's one of the great things about services like Hulu and Netflix and Amazon Prime is that people who don't live in big cities where you have lots of choice now all of a sudden have choices themselves, and they can sort of delve into and explore genres, explore movies, directors they've never seen before and have only read about.
And it's only going to get bigger and international as well. I mean, you have this arms race going on basically with the Disneys and the Apples and, you know, competing with Netflix and Amazon and everybody else. So it's just getting bigger and bigger. I would note
that people going to continue to work or spend all their time on their phones and iPads?
You know, Jim, I don't know.
80-inch television screens watching.
I know, because as we speak, there are, of course, any number of great series that have been generated, you know, on Netflix and other platforms that I'm still told I have to see. And I've seen a few that I'm absolutely smitten by. Finally caught up with the Chernobyl series on HBO, which was really well done. But I would just note, as I have in the past, that it continues to be a really big deal in other countries when one of their movies is not only nominated, but wins. I happened to be in the Czech Republic after the movie Kolya won. And it was just gigantic. And it was a great indication of just how big this event that, as an American, you just think is just sort of U.S.-centric, really resonates around the world.
Well, that is really, I think, the big theme here is the internationalization of the film industry. And we think of film industry as being based in America. Maybe you think about films that come from Britain, but the reality is the world's largest film industry, I believe, is in India. And I would imagine the Chinese film industry must be pretty large.
Nigeria has a big one. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think we should have several episodes on the podcast, Jim, just about upcoming film.
Well, we should bring in somebody who knows something more about film, okay, certainly than I do. And maybe I'll ask some questions and they can coach me up.
Point well taken. Well, we've talked our way into the Figures of the Week portion of the podcast, Jim. This week, our Twitter poll had a wide-ranging group of candidates, but the one that won, might be a surprise, was W76-2, Low Yield Warhead. So that's obviously the name of a warhead in the news. Jim, can you tell us a bit about this audience figure?
First, Bob, I have to say that I obviously should not be in the prediction business, because when I saw the slate of choices, no way did I think the W76-2 would be the winner, but it is. And it is simply the latest nuclear warhead to enter the U.S. arsenal. It's the first one actually in quite some time. Just to give a little bit of background, it appears to have been deployed on the USS Tennessee. That is a ballistic missile submarine known as Boomer in naval parlance. Now, Boomers, SSBNs, carry 20 missiles. It's believed that the U.S. Tennessee has two of its missiles equipped with the W-76-2. Now, what's significant about the W-76-2 is that it is a so-called low-yield nuclear warhead. just sort of put that in comparison, the yield of the W-76-2 is believed to be about 5 kilotons. Now, the destructive power, the yield of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima was 15 kilotons. Nagasaki was 20 kilotons. If you look at these ballistic missile submarines, the other warheads carried on the missile have yields of either 90 kilotons or 455 kilotons. So this is, again, low yield, low end of the spectrum in terms of yield, and that's precisely the point. This is actually sort of the first manifestation of the Trump administration's nuclear posture view, which came out, I believe, in February of 2018. And one of the things that posture view argued for is that there was, in essence, a gap in U.S. nuclear missile arsenal of a low-yield weapon, and that created, in the view of the administration, undesirable incentives. Essentially, the Russians have, and there's some debate about this, either discussed or have moved to a policy, what might be called escalate to de-escalate. That is, the Russians putting more emphasis on tactical nuclear weapons, and that what they would do in a crisis if they thought they were using is to use low-yield tactical nuclear weapons and dare the United States to respond with its much more higher-yielding nuclear weapons. And so from the vantage point of the argument the administration, some nuclear weapons experts would make, is that this is a perverse incentive. And so the way to resolve that or address that is to have a low-yield weapon of your own so that you could match the Russians' low-yield weapon for low-yield weapon, and that would, in essence, deter the Russians.
So establish some deterrence capability that was seen as missing.
Right.
Obviously, anytime you're talking about nuclear weapons posture, there's the whole psychology aspect involved, and the sort of unthinkable aspect put to the side while you think through rational actor moves and so forth. Yeah. It gets a little bit dizzying, but...
Right. This gets to a fundamental question in the nuclear literature about what it is that deters the other side.
When I was growing up, it was called MAD, Jim.
Yes, well...
Mutually Assured Destruction.
I think you are likely to end up with Mutually Assured Destruction, which is why you want to avoid the actual use of nuclear weapons. And again, the argument that proponents make for deploying the W-76-2 is that it will make it less likely that the Russians would go for this escalate to de-escalate, that is to go first with a nuclear device, and so that sort of reinforces deterrence. The criticism of it on a sort of a theoretical level is that it actually would make the use of nuclear weapons more likely, precisely because the yield is lower, so you might be tempted to use a nuclear weapon not in response to someone else using it, but because you think it can produce the military gain that you're seeking to get. And again, having cut my teeth in graduate school in the 1980s when nuclear weapons issues were hot, I can argue this round, I can argue it square, and I think anybody in this field can. And it really does get to sort of fundamental beliefs that no one has ever been able to test about what actually produces deterrence. What about you, Bob? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is going to take us back to Africa. It is a number, and it is the number 200 billion. That's billion with a B. That is the conservative estimate of the number of locusts currently involved in an epic infestation afflicting countries in East Africa. Somalia, Kenya in particular, are getting hit right now. And there's a great deal of concern at the size of this locust cloud because they are capable of destroying a huge amount of food stock, of farm staples, basically, in part of the world.
Anyone who's read the Bible knows.
Absolutely. And with, you know, recent memory, people have pointed to an infestation that hit a number of years ago in Mali that wiped out like 90% of one of the staple crops there. These are worrisome, and when they are in this sort of voracious swarming phase, they are harder to combat than when they're sort of in their earlier phase of development. So typically, the drill is to just kind of withstand it, and then, you know, the international community chips in and helps, sort of lift the countries out of this. I think they're still trying to figure out how to prevent, because these are still hungry locusts that are still able to eat and reproduce and carry on. And so it's a test and it's an affliction these countries can ill afford given everything else going on there. So it's yet another test for the international system in Africa.
Do we know why periodically you have these massive swarms of locusts? I mean, this is something that goes way back millennia. I mean, I mentioned it was talked about in the Bible.
And it is something that seems to be historically afflicting the Middle East, North Africa in particular, Jim. This particular swarm is believed to have started started actually in the Middle East, on the Arabian Peninsula, crossed over the body, large body of water. I'm not sure if it was the Red Sea or the Gulf of Aden. And it is believed to be set off by climatic conditions. If things are too dry, it kind of whips up the locusts into a frenzy looking for food. And the way it's described in a piece I read this week in The Economist, you know, the locusts go from individual actors to acting as part of a giant unit, the way they see as being able to enable them to travel great distances and find the food that they need. It is a phenomenon, and it has to do with the particular climate in that part of the world, Jim. But I haven't seen a good, other than the sort of get them in their young approach, I haven't seen a good approach to actually combating something the size. The descriptions are crazy. It said there's a 3 times the size of New York City is the size of one cloud that's over eastern Kenya at the moment.
I tell you, if you see the video of these swarms, it is astounding. It is your worst horror film on steroids. It is hard to believe that you can have that many insects. And again, you can see how they can be so incredibly destructive.
People in this hemisphere will point to various insect infestations, but they're just not on this level. You know, you do have grasshopper and moth and all sorts of other things happening, but the cycle is much less severe. So again, we'll keep an eye on Africa and hope this is able to pass by without the deep bite out of their food stocks. But Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure?
Bob, my figure of the week is a person, and I'm going to go with the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. By any objective measure, he had a very good week. Obviously, the biggest news of the week was that he was acquitted by the United States Senate on a near party line vote. Only one Republican, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, crossed the aisle to vote to convict the president. He did that on one of the article of the abuse of power. So obviously, it's a big deal for a president to be acquitted. But we'll also note he gave a State of the Union address on Tuesday night, which I think from a political point of view was very effective. He set up the issues he intends to run for re-election on, and I think he did so effectively. And the president no doubt benefited from the issue we started talking about on the podcast, which is the botched vote count in Iowa. I mean, the president was quick to go on Twitter and say, essentially, why would you vote for Democrats? This is how they can't get things done. The Trump administration is getting stuff done. Now, I will note that the president has kept an army of fact checkers employed, trying to track down all the things he said.
It's a new industry that surfaced, especially around the State of the Union.
And I will acknowledge that the president in his State of the Union address said a lot of things that were factually untrue, said a lot of things that sort of took statistics and stretched them to the point where they lost all meaning. And I feel for people like Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post, who has been doing this for quite some time and doing it quite well. But acknowledging that, I think from a political point of view, if you're Donald J. Trump, this was a very good week.
Yeah, and he was able to, amidst the embroidering of the truth, to bring forth a vision of America bouncing back. And it's all part of his, you know, this is part of his four year ago slogan as well, Make America Great Again. And he's saying he's in fact delivering. And he was able to point to one thing after another, and then the human touch, which is always introduced to these State of the Union speeches as well. One surprise on the foreign policy front was actually the person the U.S. recognizes as the leader of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, as well appeared there.
But that was also a weakness, because the fact is Juan Guaido is here in Washington, D.C. He's not in Venezuela. And I think that sort of attests to how events have moved against the protesters in Venezuela. It's more a sign of weakness rather than success. I actually was surprised in the State of the Union how many issues the president didn't talk about, at least on foreign policy, perhaps because they don't play into the campaign narrative of how successful his presidency has been. One that stood out for me was North Korea. I believe last year's speech, North Korea featured prominently. This year, no mention of North Korea. Did talk about China in terms of trade, but not on anything else. Didn't talk about climate change. Made a reference to planting trees, but no real attempt to engage there. So it was a speech that was clearly designed for the campaign trail, and that's what presidents do. This was a little bit different. It had more sort of game show, Oprah Winfrey, Ellen DeGeneres moments, you know, bringing people out on the stage, awarding them scholarships and the like. But again, I think for a lot of people watching it, certainly for people who like President Trump, they thought it was great.
And he's going to be able to, all things being equal at the moment, run on the economy. Amidst the, you know, the exaggerations, he can point to near historically low unemployment and growth. Even if it's modest, it's still growth, where a lot of the rest of the developed world is not registering growth levels. And he points to the markets a lot, which, you know, a minority of Americans are actually even involved in. But he's able to point to indicators that show an economy that is in a solid space. Things can always change in the course of a year, obviously a very long time. But I do think it's interesting that the omissions that you mentioned, Jim, and North Korea and China, to some extent, are gigantic ones.
Certainly. But while they may go unmentioned in the speech, those issues are not going to go away. The fact you don't talk about something doesn't solve the problem.
And that's our look at the wild and woolly world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Iran commemorates the 1979 revolution with a speech from President Rouhani. And South Africa's President Ramaphosa delivers his State of the Nation address.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anu Kumar, Claire McGraw, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Anthony LeBarry. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long.